What am I saying?
This is MPW
the podcast with your host Zylo Aria.
Cool.
A podcast about music production
for the everyday musician,
where we learn from experienced studio engineers and each other.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the MPW podcast. I'm your host, Zylo Aria, and today I am really lucky to be joined by Simon Todkill. So Simon is a producer and also the chief engineer at London's Moloco Studios, and his credits include so many amazing artists, some of which include Elton John, Bastille, Kanye West, and many, many more. So great to have you today, Simon.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, pleasure. And yeah, thanks for putting up with my random Mac update last time we tried to record this episode. So yeah, gotta love those auto updates on the Macs.
That blank screen. For anyone that's listening, we were trying to do this interview last week and it went to hell because we were trying to set up a Zoom call and Zylo's Mac just decided to not boot because of an update. But we're here now.
Yeah. We are here now and we are here to chat about EQs, which I am very excited about. So before we get onto our topic, which I'm sure you have lots to share with us on, I am keen to hear a bit about your journey in music and how you got to where you are today. So did you want to give us a little bit of a background into your journey?
Oh, yeah, okay. I think I have a genetic defect, basically, that makes me, I'm happy to listen to the same song on repeat all day, every day.
Always good for
so
an engineer.
I think I'm predetermined that I was going to do something in music. But no, I think I started out like most people. You noodle around on an instrument, you play in different bands or you play with your friends. I mean, for me personally, that just led to slowly learning how to record yourself. You know, I never had a four track or anything like that, but I had, you know, my family was quite technological. We had computers from a young age. And so I was trying to learn to record sounds and make weird sort of beats or like play with my voice on like an early version of Cool Edit. And then that's just like led to, oh, I can make songs with this. And then I had some crazy early version of Pro Tools that I used to try to record my friends' bands with, my band with. And then it was one of those things. Like you get to that point where your band is playing shows and, you know, I was chatting to the sound engineer more than I was chatting to my band. And I was like, oh, there's actually these people who it's their responsibility to make or help bands get their ideas across or help artists sound really good. And that fascinated me. And that kind of just snowballed. So, you know, rather than having great band practices, I was trying to make our band sound really good in the garage. And then, you know, at some point I realized actually there's a job for this from doing tours. And I fell in love with it immediately. I still remember the first time I walked into a recording studio and just seeing, you know, a large console and then drum kits set up and a live room and, you know, big monitors. It was just, I was in love immediately. And from there, it was just, I've been lucky enough to time things really well, I think. Because I started, there was a studio in Sydney called Electric Avenue. Mm-hmm. And my friends G and Espo were the assistants there who I met through college. Mm-hmm. And they were really cool. They brought me in on a big session where they needed extra hands. And so I got to spend a few weeks there shadowing and watching all these decisions get made. And it was amazing hearing, like, sitting at the back of the room, watching these producers talk about things. And, you know, obviously we've all sort of got our opinions, but, you know, of course, keeping them to myself, listening and going, oh, wow, they did what I would do, or they've done the complete opposite to what I would do. And like, I found that really fascinating and how there's so many roads to get a great result. And from there it was just, you know, having seen a session firsthand, I couldn't let it go. So I did the same thing that most people do. So I went and got an internship at a studio, which from there I went to a place called Studios 301, which is in Sydney, where I ended up being for almost 9 years. When I started there as an intern, I worked there for, you know, on a 3-month internship program, sweeping floors and washing the studio car and, you know, all the jobs that nobody wants to do. And worked my way up. I ended up working for free for them for far too long, but I eventually got a job there because they fired the runner to give me his job. I think I put my head down. I was happy to sweep floors and like get rid of the ants and, you know, all the horrible little jobs. And eventually I got a job as a runner, which meant I could go out and get lunches for people and help set up and do all those things. And then that just snowballed from there. So got to be an assistant engineer. and learn from some amazing engineers, the in-house people I really, really look up to, still look up to, as well as all the external engineers we had coming in and all the producers that were dropping in from all over the world, because it was one of those studios, or is one of those studios that they... It's sort of a hub for that part of Australia where people just come and go. So getting to work in that environment with a great team, you know, I feel really lucky that the people that I who were also assistants at the time that I was assisting out there now making records that people are listening to. And I feel really privileged to be part of that culture. And I ended up being there for like, say, nearly 9 years and, you know, worked my way up to engineer. And when I left, I was the senior engineer there. Training their younger engineers. Yeah, it's a really good community. I feel lucky to be a part of that. But then for me, I grew out of that. I needed to challenge myself more. I felt like, well, hang on, I feel like I needed to challenge myself a bit more. So I decided to move to a country where I knew nobody, but I loved the music. And a lot of the records I have are produced and mixed at Townhouse Studios London or by Nick Launay and all these amazing producers and engineers who were from London or from the UK. And I thought, well, all right, well... If that's where all these records I love are being made, it's time to go there and give it a shot. So I came here with a backpack and not knowing anyone and, started from scratch again. And it's best decision I ever made. I think challenging ourselves in any regard is always a good thing. And, then I ended up, through my old management, I got an introduction to one of the old directors of Moloco. And so we got together for a meeting. And after chatting for a little while, I realized, again, timing was good. I happened to fill a skill gap that they had, and I was able to start doing engineering sessions with them. And that pretty quickly led to training their assistants and helping them build their studios and consult on a lot of things, which over the last few years has led me to my role with them for the last couple of years now, where I'm their chief engineer. So again, similar role to what I had in Sydney with 301, where I jump around all their different studios, make sure everything's up to scratch, make sure that... You know, all the things, making sure the studios run good. Anyway, it's a long, boring story, but now I'm with Moloco and the team is, can I swear, it's fucking amazing. The culture here is brilliant. The team is one of the best teams I've ever been a part of. Everyone really cares about making great records and that's all that matters.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Sounds amazing. And yeah, I mean, I can relate to that feeling of, you know, similar story with me. I was kind of looking at a lot of my favorite artists and seeing that London was just a commonality in a few of them. I think it feels very scary when you first are like, oh my gosh, I'm landing in this place that I know nothing about. But I think every time, it's always felt for me that every time I've done something that initially felt really scary, there's always been some really amazing things that have come out of it. And it definitely sounds like that for you.
You just got to follow your nose, don't you? I feel like if you're doing what interests you, you'll find a way to do what you want to do.
Yeah, I completely agree. And even when I think sometimes to other people it might seem like a silly decision, but if it feels right to you, then you know best.
Totally.
Sometimes.
And what's the worst that could happen, right?
Yeah, let's not go down that path. But... So, of course, today we are talking about EQs or equalizers. And, usually we start in the episode by defining our topic in one sentence. So sometimes people find this very challenging, but do you have one sentence answer for me, Simon?
I do. I think I do.
Okay.
What's an EQ is what we're defining. How to define an equalizer. It's really simple. It's a volume control for frequencies. That's all it is. It's all it is. That louder, this quieter, that frequency, done.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good. That's probably one of the shortest explanations we've had so far.
Half a sentence.
Yeah, great. Cool. So in what situations would you decide to grab an EQ?
I think there's probably only two situations, I think. One would be to solve a problem. You know, if you're hearing something that's really annoying in a specific sound source, you know, something you can't change with, you know, an effect or, you know, changing the microphone or whatever, or to glue sounds together. For me, equalizers, have you ever tried to, I'm sure a lot of people have done this, where you try to EQ something in solo and you think, my God, my voice sounds amazing. And then you place it in a track and go, oh God, what have I done? It's so wispy. And it's, you know, EQ on its own, I don't think I think you can solve problems that way. So, like, you know, finding annoying frequencies or something that may have gone awry in the recording. But yeah. For me, it's about gluing things together. So, yeah, two situations would be fixing a problem and then gluing sounds together by, you know, if there's a lot of bass in the kick drum and there's a lot of bass in the bass, finding, you know, shaping those together.
Cool. Yeah. No, that's great. And would you say that you could put EQs in specific categories, or would you say that there are certain types of EQs that you'd come across?
Yeah, you can. So there are a handful of types of EQs, really. The most flexible and probably the most common for people with, say, DAWs would be a parametric EQ, where, you know, they're sort of those ones where every setting is available. You've got a volume control, so the gain. You've got a frequency selector, as well as a Q value control, which is like the width of the curve, if it's a bell, or, you know, the shape of the shelf. And they're the sort of three main settings of an EQ, of a parametric EQ. You've got semi-parametric EQs, which on the console I'm sitting in front of, it's a Neve console, which those EQs are semi-parametric, where you've got a volume control, the gain, as well as the frequency selector, but you don't have, say, Q value control, or, you know, you have set frequencies. So that's kind of like halfway between parametric EQ.
Yeah.
And then really like graphic EQs, I guess, would come next. So they're those ones with super high notches, which usually have the Q value is proportionate. So depending on how much gain you give it, the Q for changes, but they're set frequencies and you've got volume control. So it's semi-parametric, but they sort of, because the Q is so sharp, they just call them graphic EQs. And there's some other weird ones in there, which are like variations of that, like a shelf or whatever. But for me, the main ones are parametric and semi-parametric. And I guess, to be fair, you could kind of throw filters into that as well, because they're controlling frequencies as well. And for me, filtering is probably as or more powerful than EQ, really. It's a heavily underused tool, I think, and it's so powerful.
Okay, cool. So you mentioned a lot of different words there, which we will go on to defining a little bit. So you mentioned a few different parameters there. So, I mean, gain is something that you'll find, and I guess that's kind of easy to define, but you mentioned as well Q, and are there, you know, you mentioned the different types of EQs. Are there certain controls that you're likely to find on most of them?
Yes, you'll always have gain, you know, so your volume control for that frequency. And I think most people would be familiar with volume. We sort of have it everywhere.
Yeah.
Every EQ will have a frequency. It will always have a gain. They're the two things you'll find on every EQ. And then the rest is dependent on what the function of that EQ is. So the Q value, for example, I sort of half touched on it, I think, which if you think of, I guess a lot of people are familiar with the DAWs and the basic EQ that's inside them. And when you have a bell curve EQ and you boost that up, it's like that little mountain that appears, how wide that Q is. And if you pull it into a really, really high value Q, it becomes sharper. And so it becomes more like a graphic or a notching sort of function where it's you can really nail in on like on a specific frequency and just pull that out or, you know, boost it. And then the lower the Q value is, the wider it becomes.
Cool. So would you say like a high Q looks a bit like a Eiffel Tower and a low Q looks a bit like a hill?
Exactly. That I couldn't have put it better myself.
Cool. Okay. So those are three things that we will find on most EQs. So you mentioned the Q value, the gain, and also the filter frequency. Cool. Also, there are certain types of filters sometimes that you would find on EQs, I guess. So you mentioned a bell curve. Would you say that there are certain types of filter shapes that you would find across EQs?
Yeah. So, I mean, bell and shelf are the two main ones. Then I think filtering sort of comes into that as well, where you can have a high pass or a low pass filter, which essentially they just wipe out every frequency above or below where you set them, depending on whether it's a high or low pass. And then how vicious they get rid of those frequencies is the slope. So that's a new word for you, a slope.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like a soft slope would be a 6 dB per octave, which is a nice, like a light walk up the hill. And then as you get towards that higher value, like the Eiffel Tower reference you mentioned, there's a like, you know, your 36 dB per octave, where you're kind of, you're basically climbing a mountain at that point.
Love these analogies. That's great. Cool. Yeah. And I remember when I started, I used to always get confused between high pass and low pass because high pass lets the high frequencies pass. But I used to always focus on all of the lows that are going away. So I'm like, oh, but yeah, I don't know why.
They get interchanged, the meaning, the words. So it's high pass and low pass filter is what I've always called them. But then it's the same thing, high and low cut filters. Because some people change pass to cut.
Yeah.
I think that's why it gets confusing though, because that one word changes and it completely changes the meaning, right?
Yeah, it's the opposite one. Yeah. When you change the pass to cut, yeah. Cool. So this is something that I feel like we hear talked about a lot with EQ, which is boosting and cutting. And some people are like, oh no, you can't boost sounds, or, you know, cutting is always a way to go, or vice versa, or whatever. Do you have a preference?
For me, it depends how I feel about the sound. Because you just said I can't boost. Now I want to boost.
I didn't say that.
No. But okay. That's the arrogance in me.
Right.
No, I think they really are. I mean, I think about this sort of stuff a lot. This is the kind of thing that I'll be sitting in bed at night thinking, how? Why? And it's really stupid, but I've spent a lot of time thinking about and trying things and seeing what works. And if I want to get something to feel really bright, or I want something to feel really airy, almost always I find that reducing low frequencies gets me a smoother, more natural sound to do that.
Right.
And I think that's because I know that there's no information up there for me to boost. It's just going to start sounding harsh and brittle is probably a good word to describe it, where you're pushing up artifacts, not sound. But cutting gets you a really, really similar result, and it sounds smoother and more natural. This is the kind of thing I mean. I've considered this a lot. You know, why does it? Why do I boost this and it sounds harsh and it's brittle? And it's like, well, actually, because the technical side behind it doesn't support what you're doing.
Right. Wow. Okay. Well, this is why you are doing what you're doing, because this is what you think about all the time, Simon.
What else is there to do at 3 a.m., right?
That is true. It's interesting to think of it that way because, there's a lot of different explanations that you get for that. So I think if anyone did not understand that, let's just say because Simon Todkill has spent a lot of time thinking about this and has agreed that that's the way to go. So another thing that some people say, or sometimes you hear, that there are certain rules about, and, you know, interested to hear if you have any kind of rules for yourself or kind of any go-to settings that you often use for certain types of sounds, or is it always very song specific?
Totally song specific. I've tried that in the past as well, building mix templates, building vocal templates and things. And to be fair, I do have a vocal recording template. And that's just because when you're recording vocals, the last thing you want to do is get in the way of that performance, and you've got to really work quick to make sure that you want to be talking with the artist and making sure, particularly when you're trying to work a performance out of somebody and help them be comfortable. And I don't want to have the technology be in the way. So I do have a vocal recording template, but then I'll often redo everything as I get to the mix. And that's usually just effects and delays and compression, just so as soon as you step on it, someone steps on a mic, it sounds banging. So I do have a template in that sense. That's purely a creative tool in that I'm trying to make the technology invisible to the artist. But in terms of how I treat a sound, it changes every day. And that's just because that every song's different. You know, sometimes a really clear, you know, upfront sound is exactly what a song needs. You know, if you're going for, like, you know, a Bill Callahan vocal type sound where it's, you know, he's right up there in your face with, he's ultra close to the mic, and it's, you know, that sound wouldn't work for something, you know, like an Atoms for Peace track with, you know, their reverbs and delays, and everything needs to be treated differently. So I know you were talking about EQ, but actually I try to touch EQ almost last for me, because like I say, it's often a problem solver, or it's to match sounds together. So say if you're recording, right, you can solve most problems you might want to grab an EQ for, by changing a microphone or changing a mic preamp or asking someone to step closer to the mic to get more body. There are so many tools we have that we can change the tone of an instrument with, and that's all EQ is really, it's volume control for frequencies, but It's all about how it's the tone it's giving, right?
Mm.
And so simple things can create such a different tone, or blending of microphones can create such a different tone. So if you're in the situation to record something, you know, having two microphones on a guitar, for example, is a really great way to change, you know, the tone or of that without having to touch an EQ, because often the dirtier we get our hands with everything you do either takes away or adds to a performance. And often I'm conscious of the fact that moves I do, I'm always careful to not mess with something that's been done unless it really needs it. But you can often do things without, you know, free EQ. It always sounds more dynamic if you can do it with, you know, balancing something with, you know, if you say something sounds muddy, right? Often that's because there were multiple things competing in that area. And usually the simple solution is just turn something down or turn something else up. And then you've solved your problem. So, and that in itself is EQ, because you're shaping the way that something hits you. So I kind of think about it in that way, that there are so many tools we have that do the same thing, and there's so many roads to get to that same point. But I really think EQ is it's one of the most, if not the most powerful tool we have. But it's also probably the most overused tool we have.
Fascinating. Yeah, that's so interesting, because, so many people just kind of throw an EQ on every single track and have something going on everywhere. And maybe the song needs it. But I guess if you have a really quality recording where the recording has done what you want it to sound like, then maybe it doesn't need it. But I guess when you have a really nice studio and really good recording settings, maybe you have more control over that kind of thing. But
100%,
if you're doing, you know, recording electronic music in your bedroom and using some random samples here and there may be more of a need for it, I
100%.
Guess.
Yeah, particularly with organic music, you can do so much without an EQ. But as soon as you start to deal with sampling electronic instruments or whatever, effects become really important, particularly for synths. Often they sound so jarring if they're dry, you know, things like choruses, but then itself, so a chorus or like a flange or whatever subtly is almost an EQ tool, in that it is often, say, like a filter, you like a moving filter can create such a, you know, insane effect across, you know, a pad or whatever. But particularly like you mentioned sampling, so much of that is filtering things out. So, you know, if you're trying to take a vocal sample out of a song, you've often, you know, got to filter out all the bottom end. And you're right, you're 100% right that you've got to really go in. And that's the situation where, like, say EQ is the most powerful tool we have, because say there's, if you use an EQ in MS mode, you can really say isolate a vocal in a recording in some situations, because you can get rid of all the information in the side of the mix and leave yourself with the center where the vocal is, right? Which is great for pulling vocal samples out of songs.
I never thought of that. That's fascinating. So for any listeners who don't know, is that like a setting that you find in your EQ?
You can do it with any EQ. You just need to understand how to process it. So you can access, there are mid-side settings in most digital EQs in your DAW, which have an MS setting where you can access the mids or the side of a stereo source. You can also do it with analog EQs, just normal mono EQs, if you've got a few of them, because you can then flip the phase on the left and right and run it up a bunch of channels, and you can access this information by being a little more tricky with what you're doing. But the easiest way to do it is just to, if you've got a, you know, everyone's got a computer, most Logic and Pro Tools and Ableton will definitely have it in there where you can access the mids and sides, and then you can, you know, basically filter out all the junk from the sides and leave yourself with the presence in the middle, and you've got yourself a workable vocal sample that you'll be able to distort and mess with.
Of course. Oh, amazing, amazing. And of course, we are not encouraging people to take samples without copyright, because our music lawyer, Bindu, who we spoke to on previous episodes, would not be happy with that. So
No, you always need permission. You always need permission before anything's released, 100%.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Are there any problem frequencies that you often find in tracks?
It depends, actually. So, I mean, 250 hertz comes to mind, I think, because that, it's just like, it's just annoying. Everything has it. Not everything.
Okay.
Like those sort of mid-range frequencies definitely come up a lot, and it's because everything has it, right? So your voice will have bottom end in it. you know, a high played violin will have bottom end in it. That synth will have, and those are the frequencies that build up. So often somewhere around that, you know, that kind of bottomy area where it's not quite bass and it's not quite mid range, there's often a lot of information there that can build up. So that comes to mind. But it depends on the arrangement as well, because the register that you play something in affects the frequency response as well, because obviously notes are just frequency. So yeah, it really does change depending on the track, and even the key of the song will shift where, say, problem frequencies you put them are. So it's not always 250. Yeah. It's going to depend on the key of the song. But, you know, that kind of bottomy weird area range is often, you know, cluttered.
Right. Cool. Cool. Good to know. And I know you mentioned you don't really have any go-to settings. Are there like any roll-offs of frequencies or something that you do more often than
not?
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So I think I mentioned earlier, I was saying filtering is one of the most underused tools that we have, because say for that thing, like, well, there's a bunch of 250 hertz or whatever, does that instrument actually need all that information down there? Because to get like really, really, really tight bottom end, it's not rocket science, right? It's what's going to make bottom end tight. It's less information, right? So if you've got a really nice sub bass that's absolutely making those your subs rumble, putting more information down there is just going to make that feel less powerful. So that's for me filtering. I'm always taking out like what needs to be in the bottom end, kick drum, bass, or you know, anything that, depending on the arrangement of the track, that's got to be down there. But everything else, just get rid of it. Your speakers are working hard enough already trying to play back the rhythm, the kicks, the basses, the power of the music. They don't need the subharmonics of a piano in that case down there. Like, that can just be filtered out. And just simply that filtering low end really, really, really makes a big difference across how powerful a song can sound or how tidy that bottom end can feel.
Yeah. Oh, amazing.
Same for top end as well.
No, cool, cool. So do you have any tips on EQing vocals? Because this seems to be something that a lot of people ask about.
Everyone's got a vocal.
Yeah.
We do. It's the hardest thing to make sound good, and it's the easiest thing to overdo. Mm. I think less is more when it comes to vocals, which I'm sure a lot of people will disagree with me on this, because vocals are not arguably, they're the most important part of most tracks. But in my experience, you know, like I say, I've been lucky enough to learn from some really, really talented people who I look up to. And it used to always surprise me. I would be like, how does this person get, you know, how the vocal sounds amazing on this track? And then, you know, so as an assistant, my job was to, you know, you're on a large console, you've got to get recalls of all the settings. So should a label want to change a week later, it can be recalled. And I'd be going through, saving the desk, writing down all the settings for the engineer. And I'd be looking at these chains going, he's not doing anything. He's literally bumped like half a dB at 3K. Why is it when they do that, it sounds good, but when I do it, it sounds awful. It is just subtlety. It's about how everything works together. So the balance, the effects you use, and the EQ can be so subtle to get such a big result when it's the right thing being done. And that just takes listening. You really do just, we were saying there's no templates really to shortcut this sort of thing. You really do just have to listen to, particularly with a vocal, you need to listen to that singer's voice. You need to make a decision on what are they trying to say, because if how you present something sonically has a really big effect on the emotion. And certain sounds just don't need to be super bright. Certain sounds need to be dark, or sometimes something's perfect the way it is. And that ability just to listen and feel and say, you know, that feels good as it is. Just leave that. That's as an important decision as when to grab something. I'd say less is more. Bright vocals are pretty common at the moment with pop, like that sort of 6K presence thing. But you can get that with, like I say, before cutting, because as you start to make things bright or really present, it becomes fatiguing. You know, it sounds great on first listen, and then four or five times after listening to it, you're feeling tired already. That's usually a sign that something's too bright. I think you really just got to customize it, don't you? So for me, tips on EQing vocals is to really like feel that emotion of the song. What's the message? Is it, you know, is it a pop track? It probably needs to be a bit more energetic. Is it something that's a bit smoother? You know, it's really, you just have to feel it out. So less is more, I think, usually.
Yeah. No, I think I mean, of course you're right. And I think it's a thing that comes with confidence as well. When you feel not confident, you feel like you need to do more to get the same result. But having the confidence to be like, actually, that's sounding good to my ear, so it's probably good.
Are you saying it's sonic peacocking?
Maybe.
If you're not sure, a good tip for everyone, I mean, I use this all the time and most engineers and most producers do as well. And we all get lost. You're working on something for 8-9 hours and, you know, however many times you've heard the song, you stop and think, what am I actually listening to? What is this? What are we doing? Yeah. Just listening to references, refreshing, go and have a cup of tea or put on some tracks that you know that you love the sound of and just reset yourself. Because often... Yeah. The answer will present itself by just resetting because you might think, how does that vocal sound amazing? Oh, it's because my guitars are way too loud and it's clouding the vocal, you know? They often are really simple solutions to complex problems, but sometimes you've got to get there by just taking a break.
Yeah. No, I think that's really good advice. So the next question we had was around your master bus. So if you think you've finished your mix and you like the sound of it and then you throw on something on your master bus which has like a graphic representation of where your frequencies are sitting, is there something that you look for there? Like are you looking for things to be fairly flat or you know, peaks in certain areas, or again, is that different every time?
It's different. It's song dependent for sure, because there are some songs where you might only have a pad and a vocal, which will obviously look, if you were imagining it on a spectrograph, it would look different to a fully dense pop song. Mm-hmm. If I'm unsure, if I'm in an unfamiliar room mixing, and this is really thing, if you're in a room that maybe isn't completely acoustically treated or it's not treated at all, you're not going to be able to hear certain things. So a graphic representation like a spectrograph is really important because you can make balance decisions based off the meters. So what I would look for would be a fairly even response, to be fair. I would not want to see my top end, 5 dB louder than where my mid-range is, because that's telling you that there's something going on there. You know, unless that's the sound that works for, depending on the instruments, it might be exactly what it needs. But I would expect to be able to see my instruments, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. If I hear a kick drum going boom, I should see it going boom. And if I can hear bass at the same time, I should see that. And it should probably be somewhere, its fundamental should be somewhere slightly different to the bass, to the bass drum. Mm-hmm. Same as, you can generally sort of see how things dance on a spectrograph. So that's all I really expect to see is visual clarity on confirming what I'm hearing from that.
Cool. And do you have actually a plugin that you like as a spectrograph?
I've got the Isotope Insight. That's really cool because you've got all manner of nerdy things in there. You've got your waterfall diagrams, which sort of show you frequency power over time, as well as just your regular meters. But I'm pretty basic in what I use all these things for, in that I learned how to record and mix on consoles before when I was at 301. I'm so used to seeing VU meters, and I know where my bottom end should sit based on in terms of power, because they show you power of music rather than peak. And I can visually see how my bottom end should sit on those, for example. Mm. So I think a VU meter is really powerful, and I still just usually have that sitting in the corner of my screen while I'm mixing.
Yeah.
Just because I know that I know how they should dance for what I want. Yeah, so for me, it's that. But that's just, I've got the standard Waves VU plugin. For that, it's nothing special.
Cool, No, nice. Yeah, actually, I mean, I just use, there's a effect called, it's not an effect, it's a spectrograph in Ableton just called Spectrum, and it does everything that you need it to do from that perspective.
It's just a technical tool, right?
Yeah.
Whatever does it.
Yeah, that's it. So last question before we get to a couple from our audience is, what is your favorite all-time EQ?
I mean, at the moment, I have to say it's probably the FabFilter Pro-Q. Just because it can do so much. And I think everyone's using that one at the moment. Yeah. The new one, Pro-Q 3, because you've got dynamic bands and that's kind of takes it into more multi-band compression territory.
Yeah.
You've got filters. You've got as many bands as you want. It's, you can automate it. I think that's probably, at the moment, my favorite. But honestly, it changes. You know, if I think silky vocal, I do think like Pultec style program EQs or, you know, like MAG EQs or whatever. And it honestly depends on the instrument. You know, like a Neve EQ, I love the sound of on drums and, say, guitars. But, you know, an API EQ, I love the sound of it on synths. They all, and this is what I sort of mean about, well, so we touched on it earlier about how different tools have different tones. Those, say, different brands that I mentioned, they each sonically have a different imprint, even without touching the EQ or even the shape of what the frequencies do because of the Q value and the components used in them. Or, I think it's, so for me, it's about the tool for the job. So it does change, but probably the FabFilter EQ just because you can do everything with it.
Cool. All right. Well, I think we have covered quite a bit on EQ, which is great. And I got a lot from it. And I'm sure a lot of people from our audience have as well.
I'm just confused.
All confused.
So much information.
Yes, they've either got a lot or are very confused. But So we'll get into a couple of our audience questions. So we have one from Vicky Zhang from Melbourne. So she asks, what order do you apply EQ to vocals in your effects chain?
Oh, usually early on, I think. It does change, but sometimes I experiment with this a lot depending on, for every vocal, I will experiment with this. And there'll almost always be a compressor on a vocal and there'll almost always be some kind of EQ on a vocal. Where they lie in the chain, often for me it starts with the EQ before the compressor. I'm not sure why. I think sonically that just seems to end up working for me. But it does change. I often just change the order of the plugins and see what connecting emotionally to me. I'd say, but often, more often than not, I would say there's an EQ prior to the compressor.
All right, cool, thank you. And we have another question from Ryan KP, so also from Melbourne. So he asks, and you did touch on this a bit, how do you like to separate your bass frequencies?
Ryan, if you're producing your own tracks or you're producing for other people, the arrangement's the most important part. Really, really pick the parts to make sure they work together, because then I think you'll find separating bass frequencies is actually really easy when the arrangement is really good. Or if you're mixing for other people, then making a decision on what they're doing sonically. So listen to the parts, what are they playing, make a decision on who's driving down there, and that's the leader, and then whatever else is happening in that area, be it the bottom end of other instruments
next
or whatever
priority.
They play second fiddle to the other one, to the leader, and that will help you, because then you've got that definitive idea in mind on what's going on down there. You know what you're aiming for, so you just do it.
Cool. All right. Well, last question is from Natasha Tian from London. So she said, is it best to EQ sounds while playing others in your mix, or do you solo them?
Always together.
Always together.
There's an engineer that I used to assist a lot back in the day. And this is the trick I learned from him, was that he never soloed through a mix. Mm-hmm. He never, ever soloed an instrument. And I always would, particularly with him, just like, how the hell does he get everything so clear and like smooth? Yeah. And it was amazing. And I've watched engineers do it over the years, and I've practiced this myself. And it's like, it is really hard to not solo during a mix. So yeah, just try, work really hard, make it difficult for yourself. I promise you, your results will be better.
Awesome. Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much for that, Simon.
My pleasure.
It's been lovely chatting to you. And do you have much else on today, or it's fairly early-ish for you in the day?
Lunchtime.
Lunchtime.
I've got a couple of tracks I'm working on at the moment. So I've got some production bits to finish off for one song, and then I've got to start the mix of another one. So I've got a fairly busy afternoon, but...
Yeah, cool. All right. Well, we all appreciate your time with us. So
thank you for having me again.
Absolute pleasure. And I hope you have a lovely afternoon, and thank you. Bye.